Okay, I'll open the hearing for Wednesday, January 25th, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. We do have a quorum, so there's no problem there. Recognitions and proclamations, we don't have any of those, so we move directly to the consent calendar. Consent calendar items are things we've previously heard, routine nature. Is there anything you'd like to change on the consent calendar?
No, Mr. Chair. I would move for adoption of the consent calendar as presented today.
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We move down to public hearings. We have a public hearing for the formation of the Greater Toledo Pool Recreation and adopting a permanent rate levy. You didn't think you'd get there that fast, did you?
No, we didn't. Thank you. Moving us up. It's great.
So, do I open the hearing here, Wayne? Okay, I'll open the hearing. This is a hearing set under ORS Chapter 198 and 266 to consider the formation of the Greater Toledo Pool Recreation District. Today, the board will consider the boundaries and the proposed district of the proposed district and its benefits to the community and properties within the proposed boundaries. The proposed number of members of the district board and the method for their election and the proposed levy of funding needed by the district to operate. A second final hearing under ORS 198.810 will be to schedule for February 15, 2017. At the conclusion of the hearing, the board may proceed with the formation process by referring to the voters of the proposed district on May 2017 election. The question of the formation of the district will be funding as proposed.
Commissioners, if I might, just a quick report. This was a group of folks that came to you. They gave you a petition, although we're not using the petition process. But there was a group that included, as you may recall, some 49 volunteers and 240 or so other folks that were interested in seeing formation of a recreation district to provide funding to operate, maintain, renovate, and improve, as well as provide programming for the Toledo Pool and related facilities. That came to you in December of 2016. You began the process by initiating the formation question and scheduled this particular hearing. So I'd like to first enter into the record the proof of publication of notice and the affidavits of posting as required to get this hearing going. And then I would note that at the time we did this, the proposed boundaries and the representatives of the petitioners will be talking in more detail about the particulars. But the proposed boundaries would include the Toledo city limits and be fairly close to including what is in the Toledo Rural Fire Protection District is all. The combined areas would be the proposed boundaries for the district. One of the things required is if the city of Toledo is going to be included within the boundaries of the district when you're initiating the process, is that you have to have that particular action approved by the city council in the city of Toledo in order to include the city within the proposed boundaries. So when we initiated this process in December, the city council had not yet met. They did meet in January. I may be taking some of the thunder away
from
your
presentation.
No, that's fine. We have to note this for the record, that the city did meet in January to consider this. The Toledo City Council on January 4th did pass a resolution saying that they would like to be included within the boundaries of the district to be submitted to the voters to vote upon. And so we have a copy, a certified copy of that resolution, which, if we proceed again today, we'll attach to a supplemental order to bring that into the record. So at this point, you've talked about the particular information that you're seeking at this particular hearing. And I think that the representatives here can talk a little bit more about the funding and what their ultimate plan is if the district is formed. I would like to note, and please would you address also, this would include an independently elected board, mm-hmm. and what you're proposing for the method in which the board members would be elected. If you talk about that
I will.
Too. And then at the end of the, at the conclusion, I can discuss the next steps after you've conducted the hearing. So with that, I'll stop.
Okay.
So you're representative of the petitioners, right?
Yes, we are.
Okay. We'll hear from you then.
And I'm the secretary of the COPO committee. So, and Brenda is a member and co-treasurer of the committee. I want to address mainly the things that you are considering in this. First of all, the boundaries, and we selected the boundaries of the Toledo Fire Protection District because that area represents the people that use the pool. Many of the people that signed our list of supporters are from outside the city limits, and many of the people use it. The boundaries go through Eddyville. They go out toward Elk City. They are that area. They almost to Siletz, not quite to Siletz. We didn't think that it would be wise to actually include the city of Siletz yet, although they do use the pool for their Head Start and school kids, and there are Siletz people in that area. But that would have, I think, created too big an area to really do it. It goes off the Yaquina Bay Road in that area, too. So these are all people that do use the pool. They're supportive of using the pool. Many of the people that are supporters are from that area, is what I would say. Also, reasoning for enlarging it beyond the city of Toledo is simply that it's expensive to keep a pool open. That's why Toledo cannot afford it. We looked at the fact that the city forecast was that we would be $360,000 short of continuing the services that we provide at the present time by 2020. And the pool is costing about, right now, costing the city about $270,000 a year. So it's a definite want for our community, but as far as an absolute must, we can't say that it is, and we've got to be responsible financially. But it costs a lot of money to keep a pool open. And we didn't feel that the citizens of Toledo could handle the extra amount by themselves. And so in order to share it a little more broadly so that perhaps it will be affordable by the people we've included in this entire district, that's why we moved it out, too. So we're sharing it a little more broadly and sharing the costs a little more broadly. The rate that is proposed is 77 cents per thousand. And we presented to you the economic feasibility plan in the last at your last meeting, and that is the amount we worked carefully on the budgeting. The state required that we look at budgets for first and third year, but we carried it out to 10 years, actually to 11, and so that showed us that amount would carry the program out to at least 10 or 11 years. And so that's why we picked that. Yet we wanted it to be something that was at least affordable for people. And so we didn't go beyond that in terms of the amount that we were asking. We just felt like it's got to be as low as possible. But if we're going to do it, it needs to be done well. And so that's why the amount we chose was selected. And it will provide for the pool. As far as the directors, we're looking at five directors. We would like for those directors to be from both in the city and outside of the city in terms of their residency. It isn't practical. We looked at having zones, but we couldn't really have a zone with several directors in it. And it would have been most practical that we had a city zone and an outside of city zone. But that doesn't work the way the state has you set it up. So our directors are at large. And so they would be elected by the people in the entire district. And five directors, I think I said that. We are recruiting people to be directors, and I'm not going to say who we've recruited yet, but we have really, really good people that have various skills that will be important to the district. And so I'm really excited about the people who are stepping up to be directors. So I think that is a very positive thing. And we have both people from within the city limits and outside the city limits that are willing to apply.
Just,
yes?
I'm sorry, just to clarify, you said stepping up. Really what they're doing is they're willing to run for election.
That's what they're doing, yes, yes. And they can begin turning in their, what do you call the application to run, on February 4th. And so we're looking at that. We've gotten that information from the county clerk so that they know what to do. I think that the people that are stepping up to run will be a good selling point for the district because they are pretty amazing in terms of their skills and their dedication to the community. So I think that's going to be a very positive thing. Otherwise, I have put before you a copy of the plan that we gave to the city council when they considered the resolution. They wanted some more details, and this has a lot of those in it. It has the timelines that we're using. It also talks a little bit about the renovations, and that part is not, the pool does need some renovations. That part is not included in our budget, that we are looking for outside funding, grants, and large donations for the renovations. And I think we're going to do just fine with that. We've got good people writing grants. We're researching a lot of grants. The chart that's in there is not grants that we have. It is the ones that we're applying for first. So the newspaper kind of misrepresented that in an article about us, but this is just showing us the typical award amounts from these different resources, and these are ones we've contacted and know that we're eligible for grants from them.
Or the district will be.
Okay, what we're looking at, and we've got it kind of divided. The total amount, what we are looking at doing is putting a new roof on the building, a truss roof instead of the flat roof that's not adequate. Residing, doing the ADA and the dressing rooms and upgrading that. And that comes to about fixing the building itself is estimated to be about $750,000, including the roof. The other piece is the pool itself. And the option that we're looking at most favorably is to actually replace the pool, completely replace the pool. And if we do that, I don't have that. I have the total for building plus the renovation would be $1.65 million. That would include, it would cost $900,000 to replace the pool completely. Another option we have, if we can't get the $900,000, is to improve the pool with new drains. The drains in the pool need to be replaced because they don't recirculate the water, and so we're losing water, heat, chemicals, and all that through the gutters. And so just replacing that and fixing the deep end and the drains would be $550,000. So we're looking for the option of a whole new pool structure, and that is $900,000. So that's what we're looking at for our grants. And we're starting out with the roof. I think that's the plan. That's most immediate. But that is not coming from this tax base. It's coming from grants and large donations that we're working on like crazy and will continue working on until it's done. So that piece is in there. So have I addressed all the points that you wanted? Okay.
Thank you.
No, I'm here to moral support and to answer questions.
So do we have any questions?
I don't at this point. I really think this covers all the information we were looking for.
Let me have questions later. Is there any person here that wishes to testify for or against? Or?
So, and when you did, I think you've already done it, Jeff, but if would you make sure you sign up and then announce your name and address for the record? Thanks.
Thank you.
If we could you pass it all at the end and tell us to pass it out?
Thank you, sir.
My name is Jeff Doyle, and I live in Toledo, 335 Dickinson Drive. What you have before you is the whole packet is printed from the government website, so the City of Toledo website budget, the county website of their proposal for their budget estimates, and the economic feasibility study. Back in 2014, the city started talking about, well, even before that, they started talking about how the pool was in disrepair and needing help. And so I don't know that we need to go through all this. The current repairs of the existing facility, 1.6 to 2.4, as they stated, too, that they know that there is issues with that. The things that I'm concerned about, and if you haven't guessed already, negative thoughts towards this pool at this point, is going to the second to the last page, which would be their 10-year estimate on budgeting. Year 7, as highlighted, shows general fund expenses of $477,818 with revenues of $466,000, and they already start dipping into their rainy day fund, and by year 11, their rainy day fund is in the negative. Total receipts to the pool, the highest they've been since 2008, was in 2013 for $53,000. These are all things based on the pool as it would be brand new. Not in disrepair, not in, I think it would be feasible to consider not bringing this to the taxpayers until the pool is brought up to code. Speaking with SDAO, the special districts, they would be sending somebody out to inspect the building as is to see if it is insurable or not. At this point, this building closes on windy days. If it gets excess snow, they need to close it because of the roof that they're speaking about. So somebody considers it a hazard right now. And I think before we put it before the taxpayers to fund something like this, we need to have the building to code, current code, before we physically ask people to spend money on upkeep of a pool that's not repaired yet. And we all know that grants are a hit and miss thing. Sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't. So to bank everything you're doing on grants, as we so rightly know, it can be very frustrating and very difficult to do. So, any questions?
With the construction of the new pool in Newport, do you think there'll be a change in the amount of people that will be using that pool over there? Or do you think it's better?
You know, there could be. I can't speak for, you know, people that in Toledo that use the pool or don't use the pool. I know that there's a number of core people that are very, very loyal to the Toledo pool, and I, you know, I don't want to see the building close. I'm not here to say close this building or else. I'm looking at it as a safety thing too. Right now, if you open this up as is and throw it all on the taxpayer, there's a responsibility issue of, is this building safe? Well, the engineers in 2014 said it's okay to operate it, but beware, here's a little asterisk, if it snows, you should have a plan to close the building. They already close the building when it's too windy. They already close it on Saturdays because of lack of use. It's not open on Saturdays. So, I mean, there's things deeper in this, and this isn't a thing of the core people that use this. I wish they could afford it. For the taxpayers to flip the bill on this, I don't think is physically responsible. It's not. And they know it. I mean,
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm going to be straight away on this one. Do you have a problem if they send it out for a vote of the people and the taxpayers make their own choice?
That's the way it works. Yeah. I have a problem with it in the sense of, I don't think we should send it out until the building is code. So until we know SDAO, we will insure that building. They don't know that. And that's the part, the deeper part of this, being a district representative. I know they don't take things lightly when it comes to safety and stuff. That $7,000 a year in insurance costs that they have is, what, liability cost, and it's a bond, and it's a theft clause. They've got to get the building passed before SDA will pass it on and insure it. That was my biggest concern. I don't think I'd be here if this was a brand new building, and we were talking about just funding a pool. All those are, as stated, all those numbers are based on a pool that's in good shape, because they're already tapping into that rainy day fund in their 10-year period, and that's supposed to fix things. That kind of concerns me too. Is there really the support out there? Yeah, there's core support. There's people that love that pool, use that pool, but everybody paying for that pool and using it, I don't know if it would pass or not. It's up to the voters. I mean, that I will say that would be the fourth highest tax on my tax bill every year. It would be schools, county, fire, and then the pool. That's how that would go out on my tax bill. And then I'd have to pay to get into the pool, too. So,
if my calculation's correct, is it 231 on 77 on a $300,000 house is $231 a year? Is that correct?
Well, we just take $77 times however many hundred thousand.
Right,
there.
So it's 231. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to make sure that I did some scribbling. I thought.
Take on a $200,000 house, it's just 2 times 77.
Yeah, I was doing a $300,000 house.
$300,000
is
3 times 77.
Yeah. Hey, Rick. Okay.
Any other questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Any questions for you guys? Anybody?
Well, I'd be interested in the committee members' response to the fact that after 10 years, reserves will be depleted.
Okay. We have projected out 10 years. We've been very, very conservative in our expenses. So what we might see coming down the pike. He is correct. Every year it increases. The cost of running the pool increases. The tax rate, as you know, cannot be increased should it pass at 77 cents. So the city now, as it operates the pool, it supports the pool building, the personnel, whatnot. But it also has user fees, and we would indeed continue having user fees, very much as the city does. If you're a city resident, the fee is less. If you're outside the city, the fee is a little bit more, and we would continue that practice. If you're within the district, you would pay a simple user fee, and we actually would work very much like the city is with the pool now. We would offer, you know, punch cards and memberships and those kinds of things to people within the district and also without the district, but it would cost more for those outside.
Yeah. Could I respond to that a little bit, too? When we figured this, I mean, the requirements are that you show you can make it for 3 years. We pushed it up to let's make sure we can make it for 10. But also what we have done is increased the services and programs of the pool. And so that is reflected here as well. Right now, the pool is not open very much at all for like recreational and family swims. You know, like 2 nights a week, they have like an hour and a half. It's pretty low. And just on Sundays. When the pool was... people said, well, open it on Saturdays, but they didn't advertise that it was open on Saturdays, and they just tried it for a few months. That wasn't that successful. But we have included in our funding more money for personnel, which is what you need in order to have more programs at the pool. And so it's been the intention of the committee that it would be expanded. and that there would be a swim club, and there would, because there now there's a swim team at the high school, and we want to keep supporting that. So that would be a developing that, and it would be an after-school kind of thing that kids could do. And have it open on weekends and more hours for recreational and family swims, and advertise it, market it, have special events, that sort of thing. We were very conservative in terms of the pool receipts. As he mentioned, there was a point where it was over $50,000 a year with the current pool, but they have decrease the programs. The city lost a recreation director. They don't even have a director in charge of the pool now. It's just two managers. And so those programs have gone downhill. We're looking at those programs going uphill and having more involved, and so that pool receipt level would go up. We looked at 10 years instead of what was required 3 years to make sure our thing would be feasible. There will also be, this is another piece that's right now, the co-chairs of our committee are working with in a meeting with the city manager and two city councilors on the transition plan. And so there is a good possibility that there is a capital fund for the pool that the city has that has not been spent. It's very possible that money is going to be transferred so that it can be used for the initial renovations of the pool, so we can have we've got something going into that. Also, if you look at the timeline, they're looking at starting some of the construction, like the replacement of the roof, as soon as February of 2018. During that time, the pool would be closed down. We'll also have 2 months that the city will still be funding the pool. And our funds, the funds that would come from the district for November and December, would also be there. So there's going to be, you know, how you have a cash carryover or beginning fund balance that you use. Some of that money plus the money that would be coming in when the pool is closed will be available for additional cash carryover and funding that will carry us farther. We're not looking at that money, the money going to the construction. We want that to be the grant funds, but there will be additional funding. Plus, those directors are going to have to come up with it. You know, after 10 years, we're looking at, okay, you're going to have to plan for that and see what you can do. But we, you know, to ask for the amount right now that you would predict that you were going to need after 10 years would be asking too much of people, I believe. So it's not that there's not ways they can do that, but and they could, you know, if they had to, they could cut back. If they can do special events, they can get funding from other things for special programs and stuff. So I think it's viable. The engineering also, we use the engineering reports. There was the 2012, but there was also a 2014 study. Was it 2014 or 2012? 2014. Yeah, the 2014 study was done by the ZCS Engineering and also had some information from Civil West. But it doesn't show that the pool isn't going to fall down and fall apart. The roof was code when it was put in. But it's a little iffy, and where everybody's being really careful to make sure there's not a whole bunch of people in there when there's a huge windstorm, or you know, it would take 10 inches of snow to be a problem. But we close it during those things for safety, just in case. And that would be the first thing on the list to fix. I think that, but all the other things about the pool structure are definitely not in question. I mean, it's not a safety thing. It's just a, you know, maintenance kind of thing. You got to keep it up.
Any other questions?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
I think there's other folks in the audience. Just make sure no one else.
Was there anybody else in the audience wanted to? I thought I knew all the faces.
So just want to make sure.
Okay, I'll close the hearing and we'll have a discussion by the board. Any comments, gentlemen?
Well, what's our next step?
Well, commissioners, the way this works is that we would set, I prepared for you actually, an order that would set a final hearing on this for February 15th. At 9:30 in this room, we'd actually have an opportunity for folks to come in and talk about these same issues again on the 15th. We also need to do the supplemental order because we need to actually incorporate the City of Toledo's resolution approving their inclusion within the boundaries into our record for the formation. And at that point, what happens is, if you decide to move forward with it, then we would actually have a ballot title prepared that would submit this to the voters to make the final decision on whether or not this happens. I do want to note, just to make sure it's clear, that the vote on this would be, it's a combined question, because there is a proposed permanent rate levy and the question of forming the district in the first place. It actually is one vote up or down. So you either vote yes to form the district and establish the permanent rate levy, or you vote no, in which case the district is not formed, and of course there is no permanent rate levy. So it is a combined, this is one of those unique circumstances in which they're not separate issues, it's all together as one issue. So you'll be able to make that decision on February 15th, and that meets the timelines that if this does go out for an election, it would go out in May of 2017. So if you're prepared, the next step would be now, would be to, you have a supplemental order which would set the final hearing date and incorporate the City of Toledo resolution into our process.
So, well,
go ahead.
I would be comfortable with moving ahead at this time, at least to take it to the next step. I think Mr. Doyle has certainly raised some reasonable questions, whether this is the appropriate time to do this, the appropriate mechanism. But ultimately, I think it's up to the voters of the proposed district to decide that. So, let's see.
Well, yeah, I would agree. I think the question before us is whether or not to place the ballot measure before the voters, not to, I guess, evaluate the financial viability of the plan. That, I think, is up to the voters.
Okay. So, I agree with you that sending things out, that's why we send things out to vote with people, let them understand what's going on. I think your comments are, you know, valid. But that's a decision that belongs with the people of the district that's formed, if I'm correct. So,
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the order initiation of the formation of the Greater Toledo Pool Recreation District Supplemental Order to Order Number 12-16-332.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes. Okay.
We'll be back on February 15th.
February 15th, then, is the second hearing. Is Mr. Williams out in the hall? We have no other decision or action, discussion information. We go to reports. And are you here for the PMEC or both of these?
Both. Kevin is.
Yeah. So we had Dan Helen, I believe it is?
Yes.
Who was supposed to speak on PMEC, which is Pacific Marine Energy Center, which has received potential for $40 million, and we wanted to get an update. And it's he's apparently got sick. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
he called us just before the meeting. I'm sorry, I should have let you know that's coming to this. But so Dan will have to reschedule his presentation. But Rick Williams is here.
And we can't talk about it. See you.
Okay, great.
We're taking a recess.
We'll take a couple minute recess.
Okay, come back and we'll hear from the remote operated platform. For ocean, we're looking for a report on remote operated platforms for ocean science. Rick is, we've worked together on a lot of different issues over the years in energy and all kinds of things and ideas for resiliency. So, Rick, first of all, introduce yourself and give us a little background on it.
Certainly. So, commissioners, staff, I'm Rick Williams. I'm a retired Navy captain. So I'm an Oregon citizen and a career mariner. I work for a global consultancy called Leidos, formerly Science Applications International, or SAIC. Some of the things I've done in my career, I started as a salvage officer and a hard hat diver, which certainly changes the way you design things as an engineer when you start picking up people's mistakes. It gives you cause for pause. And I got into risk management and things called failure modes and effects criticality analysis when I had command of the Navy's 20,000-foot submersible. We converted her from 6,500-foot to 20,000-foot, and I was in charge of the conversion and the failure modes and effects analysis. So that really developed my kind of time travel. Think of all the things that can go wrong, plan on them going wrong, and if they don't, it's a good day. In nuclear power, we have a phrase, 50-50-90. If there's a 50-50 chance of it going either way, 90% of the time it'll go wrong. Plan on it, deal with it, and if it doesn't, things are better. So I went from hard hat diving and salvage into the Aquanaut program, saturation diver. I wanted to go from there to the Hydronaut program as a submersible pilot, and I had to take a little detour through nuclear power training with Admiral Rickover. I was supposed to flunk the interview, and I messed that up, and Admiral Rickover selected me. So I went into the nuclear submarine force as a full career through command of the submersible and then command of a nuclear attack submarine on two North Pole expeditions. Went from there to fleet submariner for 3rd Fleet. While I was at 3rd Fleet, the command and control director got fired, and I got put into that. So I ended up learning about civil military operations because that was a lot of 3rd Fleet's mission. So the disaster resilience and you know, disaster response was part of my job. I went from there into acquisition, so I've been a federal defense acquisition officer. And then I retired 16 years ago, and I've been 3 years at Tektronix and now 14 years in ocean engineering at SAIC. I was hired by Oregon State to help them with the regional class research vessel proposal that we won at the largest NSF grant in the university history. So that's ongoing now. So I do wave energy, and I'm also, the reason I'm here is I'm president and chairman of a nonprofit, International Subsea Solutions. Our mission is to learn from the Canadian model of the Canadian Scientific Submersible Facility, a nonprofit in Canada, to provide remotely operated vehicle services to the scientific and academic community in the United States. So we have a humble office in Newport, and we are in the ramp-up mode of that operation. As part of that, we put in a economic development grant that Barry Hendricks and I developed. I'll ask Barry to introduce himself. I will say that we met when we were in the five people who started the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition about 11 years ago. Five companies. It's now over 160 companies throughout the Northwest, and we just celebrated our 10th anniversary. And then also Keith Shepard, who's the general manager for the Canadian ROPOS operation that we look to for our operation. So may I ask Barry to say hello?
Sure. Good morning, folks. So just a little bit about myself. I'm also a native Oregonian, an OSU undergrad. Most of my background has been in aerospace and defense. So I worked at Precision Cast Parts, and then we bought a company called OECO in Milwaukee, Oregon, which is a power electronics business. So I've been involved sold that business a few years ago. And since that time, I've done primarily board work, both for-profit and non-profit, and some private investing. I split my time between Seal Rock and Milwaukee, Oregon area. So as Edric mentioned, I'm on several boards, including the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition, where I was one of the founding members with Rick. I'm also on the board of the AUVSI, the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, which is playing around with lots of unmanned drones. Of course, you hear lots of things about, but there's all sorts of ROVs and robots and whatnot, so it encompasses all of that. In addition, I'm on the board of OMAP. I'm the chair of the OMAP board, which is Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And then along with Rick, I'm the treasurer for International Subsea Solutions.
Keith?
Hello, gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe. Keith Shepard. I started as a manned submersible pilot about 35 years ago, and since then moved from a government-supported and funded operation to it was put out to the government didn't want to support it anymore, so the university researchers started up a not-for-profit in 1996, and then I've been contracted to operate that and manage that whole operation since that time. So we've done multiple deployments worldwide over the years on many, many different ships, many, many different nationalities of clients, and we've worked on and off out of Newport over the years, but feel it'd be better to see what the possibilities are for operating out of that on a more regular basis. And we're currently on board a large Russian icebreaker on the Antarctic Circumpolar Expedition, and just sailed out of Hobart a couple days ago, and I helped mobilize that, and then just flew home to start preparing to demobilize it in Punta Arenas, Chile.
So, for the purpose of testimony, my name is Rick Williams. I'm a citizen of Oregon. My address is 18,000 South Shiloh Lane, Oregon City, Oregon. The application that we turned in is to request county assistance in the economic development realm to assess the market for a home-ported, remotely operated vehicle of the Ropos flavor here, assess the customers, and assess the vessels. What we propose to do in the application is Mr. Hendricks and I, pro bono, would do the interviews with the local scientific and academic community to assess that market, determine if we can identify customers who would use ROPO services, and identify vessels that could host the vehicle in one of the many configurations. The configuration that was on the Thompson for the Endeavor array was the full meal deal. That was the deep water configuration, which requires a vessel the size of the Thompson.
Let me explain.
Sure.
Because I think there's one explanation here, and it's why you're here is because you turned in for an economic development application. I met you at a meeting at the top, and it said, "Turn in for an application." And then, in this case, you didn't get it.
Right.
And I went and looked at the application, and I realized that this is such a complicated area that you're coming into a bunch of lay people that have no background in this, because I sail and work with ROVs on ships on the undersea cable business, and I understood some of the application, but to try to put a project of this magnitude into a one-page economic development grant was almost an impossibility. So after a phone call conversation, I asked you to come and give a presentation in front of the whole board, because I thought this was a bigger project. So, excuse me, but I wanted to explain why.
Sure.
You came. It was at my request, not because I didn't think the board did a good job on the application, because I'm really satisfied with the board, but in this particular case, it's so complicated, and as you get into some of this and some of the description of it, I think people understand this is a lot different than most applications we see at a Lincoln County board level for an application for a $15,000 grant.
Well, and Commissioner Thompson gave me specific direction to keep it simple, and I'm pleased to say that I was able to follow those instructions, because we got feedback it was too simple.
That's right.
Starting in the big picture, a remotely operated vehicle is a substitute for, well, as an ocean engineer, it's part of our toolkit as ocean engineers. Now, starting as a hard hat diver and a saturation diver, you clearly want to use divers. As a submersible pilot, you clearly want to use a manned submersible. The problem is divers have a very short bottom time, even saturation divers. Manned submersibles have a limited bottom time. A remotely operated vehicle has an extended bottom time. As long as the ship is on station and the vehicle's operating correctly and the host ship has power, the remotely operated vehicle can have an extended bottom time. We also know about autonomous vehicles like the glider program that Dr. Barth has. So the idea of providing scientific services with a remotely operated vehicle would benefit with the Wave Energy Test Center. The Pacific Marine Energy Center, PMEC, would assist with NOAA, would assist with scientific research. And one of the things that I found as I was working on wave energy over here and up and down the coast, it's a case where the cobbler's children have no shoes. You are one of the three primary oceanographic ports in the country, and yet the amount of oceanographic data off of Newport is very limited because the ships are leaving or coming back. They don't spend time doing core sampling and research around here. So that's one of the things, we were looking at embedment anchors. I did a study of use of embedment anchors at the North Energy Test Site. We just don't have the kind of geotechnical and geophysical data to make good decisions that PMEC will need. So we think that there's a market. Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, we made this application as a nonprofit. We think we're a nonprofit. We're having a discussion with the IRS about that, who does not think that we're a nonprofit. So one of the aspects of our initial assessment that Barry and I will do pro bono is, does the fact that we're a nonprofit or not make a difference to the potential customers? Because the business model has been proven successfully in Canada. It's just not passing muster with the U.S. Infernal Revenue Service, Internal Revenue Service. So I don't know if that makes a difference, but that's one of the things that Barry and I will assess with the customers. Now, I will say that we're very lucky to have Mr. Hendricks on our board. He's a proven CEO in aerospace and defense and one of the most respected people in the Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition. Barry and I will have to convince each other that there is a market, an addressable market, that there are identifiable customers, and there are practical vessels to host the vehicle before we go into the phase that would use the county funds. So we laid that out in the application because I'm a taxpayer. If we don't think there's a market, if we don't think there are customers, if we don't think there are vessels, one, we wouldn't be here, but we certainly won't use the engineering funds to do loadout plans on ships. Now, that said, we know that we can work off of the Oceanus and the shallow mode. We know that we can work off the Shimada. So the question is, does NOAA have vessels that they want us to do loadout plans on? Because for those who, you've read about ships capsizing and, the concern for like fish boats, how much ice and fish they have, that gets into buoyancy and stability. So in addition to the pesky details of how do you connect this kind of equipment to the deck of a research vessel or the Pacific Storm for that matter, there's also analysis of buoyancy, stability, centers of gravity that we would do as part of the loadout plans. And the naval engineering firm that participated in the Marine Technology Society conference here made a very positive impression, and we would intend to use them. Because they've invested in coming down to Newport, and we think we got to invest in them. It's part of keeping the people who are interested in working here ought to help the others who are interested in working here. In an ideal world, we will find an addressable market. We will find identifiable customers. We will find vessels. We will, subject to your approval of the application, have the funds to do the engineering and naval architecture, to do loadout plans, so that we can then go to the customers and say, we're ready, and with our colleagues up at CSSF in Canada, offer the ROPO services at a lower cost than a commercial company. And even if we end up as a commercial company, we intend to do that, because the business model is to retain the earnings here in order to build another system that would be home ported here.
Can I, if you don't mind if I stop your...
Please do.
Because this subject of potential buyers, I've had a lot of experience. In fact, one of the reasons you and I worked together was originally on the VibraCore.
Right.
A VibraCoring device is a device that has a vibrator on the top, and it has a long pipe and a tower, and drops the pipe down in the bottom. If you're in sand or hard substances, you can't just drop like a piston core where there's a weight on it. You have to have it vibrate down into the sand. And the first time I was exposed to VibraCores, it was a New Zealand company that was coming all the way here to work off my vessel. Mm-hmm. And it cost a lot of money. I mean, it wasn't huge, but because my vessel was inexpensive compared to some of the big boats. And I said I'd done that work, and then I did work for Washington Department of Ecology, and I did the VibraCoring down the Columbia River with William and Mary out of the East Coast. There are so few people in this area, and Rick's absolutely right, that there's potential there for not only us, but the whole West Coast, because there isn't a lot of these types of devices around.
Right.
This is a submersible. The VibraCore is a different thing, but when Rick came to me and said, take a look at the VibraCore for out here, I went down and went to it, and half as big as my whole boat. There was a different type of VibraCoring that I hadn't done. But over the years, I've seen us spend a lot of money bringing devices from out of the area. And I agree with you, we need to do an assessment of how much of that works there. But I work with undersea cables, and we're always bringing ships in to do surveys on cables with the magnetometers available to reach underneath the water. And hopefully this device would have that. So there's a lot of days in that work alone if this device can do that kind of work.
So that might be the, you know, it's somewhat of a chicken and the egg. What vessels are home ported here that we could mount out on and conduct operations? And then is there enough work to justify an offshore support vessel? Because one of the things that we're really lacking in, you know, support for the PMEC is an offshore support vessel that can do anchor handling and whatnot. Because you can do anchor handling, and you can do anchor handling safely. My vote is do it safely, which takes a class of vessel that we don't have here right now. So, you know, it by having a submersible or, you know, a scientific remote operated vehicle home ported here, that could attract a vessel that could then do the kind of thing. As opposed to sailing a cable ship with their work class vehicle, we could sail a ship out of here and do the initial response inspections, potentially, because, you know, subsea engineering has, there's a Quinault word, skookum. It's an Indian word for warrior-like. Those are skookum remotely operated vehicles on those cable-laying ships. We think we're a little more agile and can do a lot of the things, as evidenced by laying out the power cables for the array. That's, you know, Keith, would you please discuss the cable deployment operations that you did off the Thompson?
Yeah, sure. So we developed a system where we can hang a cable drum directly from the vehicle, and in one dive we can take the cable down to the seafloor, pull a connector off one end, mate it to a subsea platform of some sort or other cabled infrastructure, hop back on the cable drum, pick it up, and lay up to 20 kilometers of half-inch cable and drop it at the far end, pull the other connector end out and then connect it into an instrument platform or sensor network or something, and then recover the empty drum back to the surface. We've also done a lot of cable surveying with the TSS systems and so on. So we're good at that. Well, we're too small to do any major cable burial, but we do have zip pumps and so on, so we could do little bits of things at a time. But we've installed all the extension cables for the Canadian undersea network and then installed all that equipment again for the U.S., well, they kept changing the name, but RSN, or Ocean Observatories Initiative System, that's off Oregon now. And so it's quite a remarkable system, and high reliability in getting the whole thing installed.
So let me add on to that, because I laid the RSN cable offshore and was at sea for 2 months laying the big cable that went out to axial seamount and also the one that comes in here off Newport. But in the agreement signed with Oregon Fisherman Cable Committee is an inspection period of, we have to re-inspect after 5 years, and then after every 8 years we re-inspect again. I think where we're at now, we've moved it up longer over time because we found so little change in the cables so far on the ones we've re-inspected. So that kind of work would hopefully be able to those inspections would be able to be done with this device. And if you, I think we're at 12 or 14 cables now in the state of Oregon, that's a lot of work.
It is.
And it's a cost a lot of money the way it is, and this device can do it for less. I've never seen a cable company doesn't like to save money. So.
Well, and we're sending that work out of state,
right?
So we're mobilizing, which is a waste of money. We're sending the money out of the state, and then we're spending money on demobilization. Now, the elephant in the room right in front of you, I don't know if you can see it, is called JSON. The National Science Foundation has put a lot of money into Woods Hole, and Woods Hole has observed ROPO's operations, and the finest compliment we could get is you know, plagiarism. And they're not in class, so plagiarism is not necessarily bad in that situation. So National Science Foundation wants the RSN to use JSON, and one of the ways of a little fencing here is if we can show that we have home-ported vessels here, a home-ported remotely operated vehicle, it's a U.S. company, we're cheaper than mobilizing JSON from Massachusetts, then it becomes more and more, explain to us, particularly in the current administration, why you're wasting NSF funds and why you're causing us to have a more expensive alternative to do our RSN inspections with JSON just because it's your sponsored vehicle. So there's a story to be had there as well. But that's one of the things we're overcoming is for NSF funding, they want to use JSON. And we think there's a better alternative. The other thing that we think we could do, and Commissioner Thompson mentioned that if we go this route, one of the aspects would be a letter of support from the commission. And that would be a shot heard around the world as far as we're concerned, because we can then go to Dr. Barth and Dr. Cowan at Hatfield. You know, Jack wants to build an autonomous vehicle support facility in the port for his gliders. We might be able to stake out a chunk of real estate for, you know, a remotely operated vehicle home port facility, and instead of having to build our own building, do it cooperatively with Oregon State so that they have better access to remotely operated vehicle services, and they can train students, you know, because Keith and our folks are experts on remotely operated vehicles, and that's something that the community college and Oregon State could pick up on. Is training people for those jobs.
So, if you don't mind, I'll add to this one, because in my experience over the sea, there have been probably 10 different lake cable laid off the Oregon coast. And I've always served on either Marshall Islands or British or French. Never, only the one that was stationed here, which was an Australian vessel that was here for a short time, stationed in Portland. But, and in those cases, there's this field that none of our, I don't think I've had very many, I mean, there's been a lot of people run boats, but the guys that actually run the ROVs are usually young guys from some other country. And we have programs here in our high school that started to learn how to design and build and work ROVs, but it's a big step in training from there to these kinds of jobs. But these kinds of jobs are out there. And this is one of those key things, that we had a vessel or the equipment stationed here. It would give us a direct training method to bring our own students up and start to fill some of the gaps in what is now being filled in international training. So we bring some things not just back to Oregon, but back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, you guys, go ahead if you've got any more.
I think the application stands on its own with the additional information that was requested. It was a little too simple. And it lays out a logical process. We will use what I call stage gate, where we make sure we're on the right track before we expend funds. And we're going to expend our own funds before we expend the county funds. I think we've got a good plan. I think it's practical. I'd love to have the business here in Newport, stay in Newport. I'd love to have a home ported vehicle here and help us attract an offshore support vessel that could host it. So our list of people to talk to are Dr. Cowan and Dr. Barth and Dr. Batten, and having a letter of support from the county that, the county would like to have a business here that has a home-ported ROV that can provide these services would be a big help. It certainly is an icebreaker.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
A couple of things. Well, first off, conceptually, even though I'm the one who touches this the least, basically you had me at hello. You made the case. And I have no problem whatsoever with doing a support letter. I just have one question. If we're also talking about a special fund allocation, could you elaborate just a little bit more on
sure.
what you were saying about issues with the IRS? Because traditionally, we've always allocated these funds either to government entities or to recognized nonprofits. And when
right.
you said you were having an issue with IRS about your nonprofit status, I'd just like to know a little more on that.
So, I think the best way to approach this is to consider that we'll end up as a commercial entity unless we're able to compel the IRS to be a nonprofit. They don't seem to be taking our business model because we're charging fees, and they just don't. We have not been able to convince them that that's a nonprofit mission, even though we've expressed that we're retaining the funds, we're not distributing funds to shareholders, we're retaining the funds to build a vehicle home ported here. So I think we can get started while we determine if that's an issue. We can certainly, Barry and I can do the pro bono services for the interviews. If it's an economic development special purpose fund, and you want to have a business here that does this, it's probably going to be a commercial business. And that's a good thing. Now, our business model is to retain the earnings and build a second vehicle. So we will operate along the lines of a nonprofit. Barry and I were founding board members of Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition. I was a founding board member of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. I've served on Habitat for Humanity, Ocean Science and Technology Partnership. So I've been an officer in nonprofits for the last 15 years. As has Barry, and Keith works in a nonprofit, up in Canada. So, you know, you're going to get nonprofit executives working it, whether it's a commercial entity or not.
Wayne, do you have any questions? Because this is kind of...
And I maybe will need to talk to Rick and Barry a little bit more when we're done here.
Sure.
If you want to go forward with this. And I have a couple of ideas.
Okay.
That maybe there's, if this is something you want to do. But that is the... Commissioner Hall did... That is a concern of mine, too, in terms of the way our program's set up. So, but I have some ideas that we can explore.
So I have some physical questions for you. What's... this ROV that you're proposing that would come here, I understand part of this grant is to evaluate our fleet, fishing vessels and vessels we have here that might be able to do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then this vehicle, how deep can it go?
Keith, would you cover for me while I pull up the configuration? Okay, the shallow configuration is 1,000 meters.
I got to convert.
Yeah. Okay. So
I got to convert to fathoms. I'm sorry.
Yeah, 500 fathoms.
Yes. The cable laying surveys goes to 700 fathoms off the mooring.
Okay.
Because that's the agreed line.
So the, you know, if just using like 6 feet, so it's a little over 500 fathoms in the shallow, and a little over 1,500 fathoms in the full configuration. The full configuration works on Thompson. The question is, will it work on the NOAA vessels? The shallow configuration that will suffice for PMEC and a lot of the near shore cable work, we think will work on Oceanus. Will it work on Pacific Storm? We have to determine. Again, if we were able to get an offshore support vessel here, particularly a dynamically positioned, I'd love to have a DP vessel here. It'll definitely work on one of them. So again, it's the chicken and the egg. Keith, you want to explain what I meant to say?
the shallow configuration will not support the cable laying operation, as we need our armored umbilical for that. But it will support cable inspection and the same vehicles on the end of each type of wire. The mid-depth or the 3,500 meter configuration does need a bigger ship, but the shallow we can get on very, very small ships. We've designed it to have a very small footprint, and it's quite easy to mobilize once you've done it the first time, and you can do it the whole setup within a day, sail, do your work, get back and off in less than another day. So. It's quite flexible and can use quite a few different ships. I'm not sure if that's
right.
What you wanted me to say there, Rick. But
yeah. And looking down here as far as vessels, you know, distant water fleet when they're home could support it. Crabbers, I think several of the vessels that are in the Newport Harbor would support it. As far as the bigger configuration,
if I could jump in again, we have been on the Henry Bigelow with our mid-depth, the 3,500 meter configuration, which is the sister ship to the Shimada. So we'd have to do some drilling to bolt our gear down onto the deck, but the rest we just clip into their A-frame and do the launches. So that ship that's already in Newport could support our mid-depth armored umbilical operation.
Could I ask you a question about magnetometers? Do you have a grid across? A magnetometer is a device that is a grid that goes on the front of the ROV that can tell you how deep in the mud the cable's buried. Do you have that kind of arrangement on, or do you use that on any of your ROVs in the smaller vessels?
Yes, we have used that. We did the surveys up in the Olympic Marine Sanctuary from a crabber, actually. So in our shallow configuration, we are able to support the TSS system or whatever version the client wants.
Well, and working with the Oregon Fisherman Cable Committee, they have the knowledge and the contacts. I mean, if you're going to have the choice of sailing, the Pacific Storm or Equal, with the shallow ropos or getting the Tyco underway from Portland. Let's see, let me do the math. The initial response could be out of Newport. And I think there could be, as I look at this, I have to be careful because I retired, so I wasn't going to see as much. But, I'm an empty nester now, so maybe that's okay. I think you could stay pretty busy out of here with the right vessel and the right equipment.
And I'm not sure. We have a bunch of 120-foot king crabbers that go up and they fish in salmon fishery at Tender and stuff. They may want to stay here at home for the summer, and if they can get those vessels to be workable. So there's potential, but we need to do an evaluation, and that costs money.
Sure. So, Keith, how big is the Alaskan Lady?
Ooh, we were on several of the Alaskan Enterprise, the Aleutian something or other. It's quite a few years ago. They're the crabbers that go up to Alaska for the king crab. I can't remember the specific size, but they're not very big. Some are twin screw with a bow thruster. Some are twin screw without a bow thruster, but hand steered in every case. And depending on the captain, they usually do an excellent job of supporting us without DP.
Wow. So DP is, why don't you explain what DP is? Because remember, you're talking in front of a bunch of lay people.
So I'll describe it as someone who didn't have it. I was a junior officer on a catamaran hull submarine rescue ship that was supposed to have bow thrusters. And so between the two screws that were 80 feet apart and two bow thrusters, we would have been able to hold the ship in position dynamically over a distressed submarine. So we didn't have that, so I got to learn how to do a lot of ship handling. But a dynamically positioned vessel, there are various classes that go up DP1, 2, 3. The lower the class, you have additional thrusters so that it helps the captain keep the heading and the position over a point on the bottom of the ocean or on a survey track. As you get up into DP2, you have redundancy, reliability, and as you get up to the higher levels of DP3 and beyond, that's for ocean industry when you're transferring people and equipment to a floating production storage and offloading platform. For the safety of personnel, that vehicle has to be able to stay right on station in position and withstand several material casualties. So the whole point is, and at the higher levels, the automation is significant. You enter in a position. It can either be a global positioning system position on the surface, or you can have a transponder on the bottom, something we would call shifting the mission coordinates. I'd come in. So I actually outfitted Seacliff, the submersible, with a shoulder holster deep ocean transponder launchers in the ballast tank, so I could fly in, see my target, pickle a transponder, and then we would position using mission coordinates acoustically, and then just stay right over that position. Keith, you want to talk about the DP vessels that you've worked off?
Okay, we've used the Thomas G. Thompson and sister ships to that, which have DP and typically hold station well. But one of our areas of expertise is actually operating from non-DP vessels, and we try and put a good navigation display up on the bridge and coach the watchstanders to hold station. So usually it works quite well, especially with experienced mariners. They do quite well. But as you get up into the higher level vessels, as Rick pointed out, with the other DPs, then they start to have more power to stay on station and more redundant systems. So if they have a failure, you don't lose the ship. But it all comes back to the point that it's the they're at the end of the tail wagging the dog. So if the ship can't hold station, the ROV can't do its work. So it's really critical that we have that good station keeping, whether it's DP
or experience, but we've had problems with both. So DP operators need to be aware that you can't just push the button and walk away. So some are better than others at managing that.
Some of the ones that I worked on have 10,000 horsepower rotary horsepower engines and two bow thrusters that are huge on 500-foot ships, and they can hold these ships within a foot in the ocean. And if they deploy the ROV, there's a dipole that comes out of the bottom of the ship, and you can actually, wherever the ROV wants to go, that you just plug it in and the ship follows exactly where the ROV is. And those ships do not come cheap.
I was part of the team specifying the regional class research vessel, and she's dynamically positioned, with levels of redundancy. So hopefully when we get the new regional class research vessel here, we'll have that capability. She will be a UNOLS vessel, and they are very busy. So getting time on Oceanus. Now, one of the things that the commission can help us with in that, Representative Boone and Senator Roblin helped get a bill through the Oregon legislature for oceanographic vessel ship time. And we use that to do the sonar study off of Newport and Camp Rylea. Interesting thing, Commissioner Thompson and Scott McMullen used to do gunnery up at Camp Rylea. So I get a call from the training site commander who said, I get a call from Dr. Chris Goldfinger. He said, Rick, they won't let us on the range at Camp Rylea. I said, well, did you make prior arrangements? He said, no, we just kind of came up. And I said, hang on just a second. So I called the colonel. I said, Colonel, good news. We got the ship time to do the sonar survey off Camp Rylea. Well, that's great. Other news, they're off your range requesting permission. He says, that's that big ship that's fouling my range? So we were able to get them in and do the survey. They had to, he said, they're Air Force guys. They'll take a break. So they had to take the range cold to get the Oceanus in. So, getting scientific submersible time as part of that legislated account would help us get days on Oceanus to do ROPOS operations as well.
Well, gentlemen, where do you want to go from here?
Well, let's do the letter for sure. And what I would be comfortable with at this point would be a directive to Mr. Belmont to follow up and hopefully come back to us with an alternative or alternatives that if we did want to support this, how we could do it within the guidelines of our program.
I'm certainly in favor of trying to support it. I think
yes.
We raised the valid question and we need to find a way to
I think this you know, is the kind of thing that Lincoln County has been famous for now is finding these innovative ideas to promote ocean development and then put our name behind it, whether it was trying to get the NOAA vessels here or trying to build a new campus over there. This is one of those things that's new and unusual, and it's going to take some thinking, but I think it has the potential to create jobs and
definitely
take advantage of the thing that we have here, and that's the scientific ability that lies in Lincoln County. So
I think I've got my direction.
So, and we'll work with you to figure out how we can do it. How do we get to yes?
Yeah. Any other further questions?
Well, I'm just a numbers guy, and I think the different vessels were 1,000 meters. Is that
the configurations are 1,000 meter, 3,500 meter?
Yeah, and I was doing the math in my head, and if I'm correct, 1,000 meters is 6.2 miles, 10K.
No.
1,000 meters would be 3,300
change
feet.
Oh, yeah, right. 10K versus 10K. A K. Yeah. So 1K would be 0.62 miles, about a little over a half mile.
We're going to get into.
I can
do furlongs also.
Well, I see, I'm a runner. So, okay. You know, 10K to me is 6.
So 1,000 meters is, you know.
Would be one tenth of that.
One tenth of it.
Which would be 0.62 miles, a little over half.
You highlight a problem that happens in the marine industry because fishermen use fathoms, scientists use meters,
that's why I brought
and
it up.
Lay people use feet, and trying to convert things back and forth is always a challenge.
And the county has some perceived jurisdiction out of one marine league.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, throw that in, and you know, then we can get into furlongs per fortnight, as far as a velocity.
Well, deep in the rest.
Yeah.
since we digressed on that, I had a friend of my daughter. We were talking about meters versus the U.S. Feet and inches, and he said, "Well, there's only one country in the world that uses feet and inches.
Yes.
They put a man on the moon."
Yeah. So there you go.
Okay, that kind of clarifies.
So, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about at this point? We'll do a letter for sure.
Okay.
And we'll search for.
We'll be talking.
A way to get to yes. Okay. Subject to your questions, Mr. Hendricks, do you have anything to add?
Nope. We need to continue to monitor and inform them, obviously, where we end up with the nonprofit status, which we should get that resolved in the near future.
Mr. Shepard.
Not much else to add, except that we've been working with scientists at Hatfield Marine Science Center and people in Newport for since early 1990s. So we do have relationships established there and a great reputation. And you know, when I come through Newport, we still call them up and go out for dinner or whatever. So we've spent quite a bit of time there, and I think it would be a great to spend more time there.
Keith, we do need a couple of boots and A's just to close out here. So,
so let me mention one other thing. Since Doug, you're the chair this afternoon, you're meeting with the committee, and you're here for the committee meeting. Why don't you talk a second about that?
Well, I think we're having a second or third meeting of the group to address maritime industry as a workforce sector. I think I've said this before, but Rick has said there's no such thing as a coincidence, but whatever the cause, we happen to sit down together at a breakfast and realized I think we had an interest in trying to pursue the maritime sector. I think at the time I talked about it as the marine, and Rick pointed out that maritime is broader, including both the land and the sea. So got together, and there's some interest in trying to, I think, really look at three different issues. Number one, try to get the state to recognize the maritime sector as a business sector, and that will theoretically or should help us free up some funding and help with the Oregon business plan, recognizing that we need to get data that supports what we all know as far as the career opportunities out there. And I won't belabor that except to say that when you look at the types of jobs in the maritime sector, there isn't the data that supports that. And then, third of all, there's funding through the Workforce Investment Act for job training, and I think we can develop some programs through the Workforce Investment Board for training, and also work with the community colleges to develop some training programs. So it's ultimately going to create jobs in sectors that relate very much to what we do, not only along the coast, but up the Columbia River, and really benefits the entire state. So looking forward to that this afternoon. And whatever the cause that got us together for breakfast, I'm glad it happened.
Yes, sir. And may I pile on?
Yes.
So I've been working on this for over 8 years, since I was on the Governor Kulongowski's Business Economic Development Committee for Workforce Investment. And there were no mariner jobs identified in high wage, high availability. And I mean, I'm one of the young guys. You know, there's availability out there for new entrants. And it turned out that the employment department doesn't count jobs that don't go to work in an Oregon zip code. And, I mean, we worked through Claire Berger, Lita Culligan, and I worked with the governor's office, just unyielding, couldn't make any progress. Since the commissioner got involved and we got a new look at things, the employment department has now acknowledged that they don't know where the jobs are. What they track is the employers. So if you're going out of state to work, I mean, I paid taxes in Oregon for 26 years, never went to work in an Oregon zip code. So, you know, when you look at the distant water fleet, when you look at the folks who work offshore, when you look at mariners, and there are 5,000 Coast Guard licenses domiciled in Oregon. And I can almost guarantee you they don't go to work in Oregon. So how do we get that into the equation? You know, because one of the things we're going to have to get the employment division or department to acknowledge for workforce investment, we want to know where the workers are. So the other thing for Lincoln County in your leadership role of, you know, what might be considered a harebrained idea, but turns out pretty good, I would propose a Home Port Oregon program where we go out, like with Oregon Tourism, and say, hey, mariners around the world, around the country, this is a darn good place to make your home port. Bring your families here, live in Newport in Oregon, and ship out, but you know you got a place to come back to. And those are high wages that you're bringing in as far as income taxes, and they're low impact because we're not around much. You know?
Mr. Greenwood, are you listening?
Very much so.
Yeah.
I'll be there at 1:00.
All right.
Thank you very much for coming. It's been a
little education.
Very.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you at 1:00.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Barry. Thank you, Keith.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks, folks.
Okay,
thank you very much.
We'll move down to constituent input. Bye. Any constituent input? Sorry, that took so long, but it was...
Well, I think it's a
great idea. In fact, if my wife finds out that my son has a possibility for a job here, he'll never get out of the house. So, Jeff Doyle again, this time going to go ahead and represent the Toledo Rural Fire Protection District. I did give you a handout. It was just for information only, but Mr. Belmont suggested maybe go ahead and throw 2 minutes in, and so that's what I'm going to do. That handout that you have in front of you is just where we're at with our architectural process. So, you see, we have some things completed. We're in pre-construction document phase, which just means we're moving at a snail's pace because the money that we get, we turn into documents and things. And so, we're not spending a whole lot of money doing that. And it's a time, as we talked about before, it's a time-consuming thing. We are going to sell one of our vehicles that's past its life, and we're hoping maybe a lumber company will want to take it off our hands, and that'll push the thing a little bit further forward. Just to note, we already are 501(c).
You're a public entity.
A public entity, but we are a nonprofit. I don't know, any questions on the project? Oh, we had another accident out there on the highway out of district yesterday. Icy roads, we responded. I think we're in a quandary with that because we will respond, and it is our moniker, and so there's a lot of taken for granted, and that's this chief and this board at this point. There could come a day, as represented in other parts of the county, that the line is drawn and we don't cross the line. I could say for now we're not going to do that, but if you can think of any additional funding that will help our process to get to construction document phase, and the reason we want to get there is it opens up some more possibilities of grants with the completion of documents. We have submitted a couple of documents. Starker Forest Service, we've put a grant in with them, and waiting back to hear. They don't meet till March. Got some other federal grants in the works, but now with the new administration, I'm sure that's going to change the way they do things. So we're kind of in hold there, hoping that the infrastructure bill that will probably happen, since it's supported by both sides, maybe there'll be some money there. There's a lot of maybes, ifs, and ands, and possibles, so it's not getting our coverage done. We're at a point where we dare say it's not critical, but we've been working on this for now over 12 years. And so somebody needs to start stepping up. The governor's office has been contacted, the Office of Solutions, and she sent out email contacts to ODOT, and they have not responded 6 weeks later. Mr. Thompson is working with Mr. Roblin, Senator Roblin, with making a bill before the legislature this year. It's a great bill. It's not a funding source, but it is a start.
Yeah. It's I went after it narrowly defined, though, but for certain areas, and it, because of the lack of funds this year with the hole that's in the budget, we got talking about it, and I think they're probably right. There's just not going to be any funds available for this type of thing. So we turned it into a working bill to set up a working committee to discuss the issue on a bigger scale so that it has a chance to come back in the next session if there's more money. It's better to have a working committee bring a bill forward than it is for, especially for, it would have died, and I didn't want to see it die.
So this kind of plants the flag, gets it on the legislature's radar screen, the governor's radar screen, right? And positions us, hopefully positions them when the funds are available. It kind of greases the skids.
Yeah, it has a much better chance of passing that way. And there'll be a thorough vetting of how big should the bill be. I mean, is it worries me when you can do some things, the county can do something specifically for you, but this problem probably exists.
Exactly.
Fire districts filling roles for emergencies of all kinds, and maybe we can find a bigger source of money, but
well,
we have to wait.
For our purpose anyway, I think it's a great start, and especially for the entire state, and I think it's something that was lacking attention, and it's maybe one of those things where it just got into the, well, that's the way it is kind of things, and if there is small funding for smaller districts, then we don't want to get the big districts involved. And there has to be some kind of line drawn in sand. That's where the committee that's formed could come up with, you know, how much size of a district matters in funding this particular and ongoing projects from this point on. So we're excited, support it, and we'll be a part of it for as long as, you know, you ask us to be. And
we're looking for projects to do resiliency in the state of Oregon. This is a bit for resiliency, but you need a much bigger discussion than probably.
And if ODOT is not responding to a request from Regional Solutions, maybe a little nudge from Commissioner Hunt.
Clarify what contact has been made with ODOT.
Okay, so
to what have they not responded?
Well, the first contact was at the where I met you gentlemen at the opening of the highway when I met with, I believe his name's Matthew, the head of ODOT.
Matt Garrett.
And he didn't want to talk to me at that point. He just said, hey, this is a day of celebration. We won't want to talk about your concerns, but we need to get around the table and talk with you guys. And so I called the governor's Office of Solutions, and she sent an email out just introducing me and saying, please contact to set up meetings. And that's where we're at.
That email from Jackie Michelonis?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's where my wife likes to say, chirp, chirp, chirp. Okay. The crickets are out there.
I'll reach out to Jackie.
Perfect.
And I think she's been very responsive and very, as far as at least talking to me, and I see the emails go out that says, but it's from her point, it seems to be where the disconnect is.
If there's not a response from ODOT, maybe you're nudging, and maybe perhaps nudging from Senator Roblin might help.
Yeah, and because they're getting ready to spend $750,000 to replant plants on that highway out there, and you would think that maybe something could be included in, you know, helping a poor little old fire district out. Mm-hmm. Because, again, like I said, another accident out there, single car, and we're not to summer yet. So, okay. Any questions?
No.
Thank you for the time, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Other constituent, any reports from commissioners?
Okay, maybe I could just briefly mention a couple of things. Yesterday I was over in Salem with several of the AOC staff, Association of Oregon Counties. We met with about half a dozen staff of Oregon Health Authority, talking about how we can have a more productive collaboration around county mental health programs, and especially the whole Stepping Up initiative, and you know, working to do at the state level what we're also trying to do at the county level through Stepping Up, bringing behavioral health services and public safety into closer alignment. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Eugene all day. You know, we participate and all of us are involved in so many regional efforts through the through various state programs. And this is the Cascades West Economic and Development District because the state decided, you know, we're in our usual alignment with Lynn Benton Lincoln, but also taking in Lane as well, because even though Lane has its own Council of Governments, the state says in terms of economic development districts, you can't have single county districts. So we're in a four county region. Those meetings rotate, and tomorrow it's happening in Eugene.
That's just also the same grouping of counties. That's the Regional Solutions Group.
Right.
So, any reports?
I think we've already covered my report. Looking forward to the meeting today at 1 o'clock, and have more information next time.
Okay. I attended this derelict vessel, and they're going to have a plan out in the near future dealing with boats that are sunk in the bottom, and it's going to be interesting that more and more we were attendees were from major salvage companies in the Portland and area, and it gets, as we get into this, the problem to me looks like it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's an interesting committee for me to serve on, because Lincoln County seems to have done a pretty good job of taking care of our vessels, but there's a lot.
So, Mr. Chair, tongue-in-cheek, I want everybody to know, so were you the designated ancient mariner at the table?
No, some of these guys in the salvage companies are older than me.
Wow. And may I offer up one more thing, just so folks think there isn't some kind of secret collaboration going on up here? It is merely an amazing coincidence that all three of us are wearing light blue shirts today, and the three of us and Mr. Belmont are wearing blue ties. Strictly coincidence.
I didn't get the memo.
Yeah. You only read the first part about the blue ties.
Are you suggesting there's collusion?
No.
Listen, I'm going to bring that word out. Please.
Believe me, I do not care what Bill Hall wears.
Same here. I mean, no, I don't care what Terry Thompson wears. I care what I wear.
Okay, with that, meeting adjourned.
Control of this meeting. Sorry.
Meeting adjourned, and you want to tell us the date for the next meeting?
February 1st.
Okay, February 1st, and we're going where?
Here, right here, right?
February 1st, 9:30.